who actually was able to use Florida to get the Stand Your Ground pass in conjunction with the support they have from NRA that is now perpetrating this country. It's time for us in Florida to really say that enough is enough. And if it means calling this panel back up again and addressing it, but the law is wrong. The law is vicious. And the law was okay the way it was in the beginning. There was no reason to change the law. And so it needs to be addressed. And for us, one of the things we do as we pursue to get this law changed, despite the fact what the governor says, we need to also make sure that we are registered voters and that when people call us to go and be jurors, that we do not get out of wanting to be a juror. Because everybody that I hear, they have 90,000 things that they've got to do because they cannot take the time to do that. And that's one reason why we also see the kind of numbers, perhaps, that may be willing. First, you got to be registered. And then when they call you, you've got to be willing to go.
There you go. All right. So now we're going to take some questions. Yep. Questions from the crowd. Please keep speeches to the room. Go right ahead. Yes. If you can tell us who you are.
I'm Betty T. Steinberg. I'm from St. Pete, one of your neighbors.
That's right.
I'm very wise enough to actually let us take the last time. This question is for the gentleman from the governor's office. I'm certainly not suggesting that there are any informants there, but I want to ask you if you were aware that you made the statement, I'm sure many people heard you make the statement that George Zimmerman was chasing Trayvon Martin in the middle of the night. Were you aware that you made that statement?
Are you talking to me?
Yes.
I'm not from the governor's office, first of all. I just want to make sure you know that.
Were you aware? And I guess it's more than a factual statement. It's a philosophical statement that we all think that if there's a young man walking while black, he has to be in the wrong place and it has to be the wrong time of day. If you still believe that, were you aware that you made that statement, that this man was pursuing a dangerous person with a firearm in the middle of the night?
I said that he was pursuing a dangerous man?
I have it in my notes. You said in the middle of the night.
No, he was pursuing somebody while he's armed with a firearm is what I said, or what I thought I said.
My question is about what time of day it was in your mind.
At night. At night.
It was not in the middle of the night.
Okay, what's the middle of the night to me, because I go to bed at 9 o'clock, is 7 o'clock. You know, 7 to 8 o'clock. So I'm not sure what point you're trying to make, but what I heard the trial testimony was is that he pursued someone in the evening.
Right.
So
And again, just to...
I don't know. What is wrong with that?
Just to add something, I mean, Zimmerman's contention is that he wasn't pursuing it. That when the dispatcher said, we don't need you to follow him,
It was seven.
That he hated that. So
I don't know anybody else who goes to bed at 7 and considers it the middle of the night.
Well, I mean,
I was just trying to make sure that you really believe that.
Can we have your name and your question, please?
Yes, my name is Fela Ali. I live in the Temple Terrace area. First, Dr. Collins, I want to commend you for being able to stay in your ground, one of these gentlemen. Mr. Camino, I heard you said you served on that task force.
Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to know, my question is in two parts. I'd like to know if you personally agree that this particular law does not need revision and amending, and also, how many African Americans were appointed to this task force?
The first part of your question is, do I believe that it should be repealed, or what were you specifically asking me?
That something needs to be amended, rewritten, something, modification, something done to this disproportionate draconian law.
Well, I can say I do think that there are some things that need to be revamped in the law and further explained. Yes, I do.
And how many African Americans were on this task force?
I'd have to go back and look at the number. I don't know. Five? On the task force?
Yes.
I know Sheriff Demings was one.
You were personally on that went around the country to find out about this law. How many African Americans, males or females, were on this task force, worked side by side with you?
I think we were about evenly split. Lieutenant Governor Carroll was on the task force. There was a pastor that was on the task force.
Incredible.
Hold on. Let me. Let me answer the question. I got the numbers right here. All right. Let's go through and we'll go through the numbers. All right. Lieutenant Governor Carroll. I believe she's African American. Reverend R.B. Holmes. I believe he's African American. All right. Sheriff Ashley from Okaloosa. He is not African American. State Representative Dennis Baxley. He is not African American. Justice Kenneth Bell, he is not African-American. Jason Broder of Sanford, he is not African-American either. Derek Bruce, he's an attorney out of Orlando. He is an African-American. Joe Camino, I'm not an African-American. I'm Italian. I'm from St. Petersburg. Okay. Edna Canino, she is not, thanks, Ben. She is not African-American. Gretchen Lorenzo, neither is she. Judge Krista Marks, she is not an African-American. Maria Newman, she is not an African-American. Catherine Fernandez Rundle, she's the head state attorney in Miami. She is not African-American. Stacy Scott, public defender from Gainesville, she is not African-American. Mark Seiden of Miami, he's not African-American. And then you have State Senator Simmons, he's from Altamont Springs, he is not African-American. And then you have State Senator Gary Siplin from Orlando, he is an African-American.
So you had three African-Americans.
Four. We have Siplin.
So folks, hold on. Let's stop right here. I understand that people are passionate, and I understand that people want to make their points, but we have to be respectful of each other. So let's follow me at the mic, and let's let people answer their questions, and let's all be civil here, okay? Can you hear me?
Yes, my name is Kale. I'm not important, so. But my question is for the attorneys, and I'm sorry, I'm better writing the speaker, so hopefully it comes all right. My problem is with jury selection. How do we change that, and who do I need to write to? Because to me, this society that we have where it's evolving and we're getting more information, more intelligent, why are we still letting the most ignorant of us judges? And in this day and age, to find someone to be ignorant, they either make the choice to be dangerously ignorant or they're convincing lying, and that's mm-hmm. a problem.
Mm-hmm. Any response? We've had this one juror come forward, the first one to come forward, who also seemed to have a line at the literary agent, and seemed quite prepared to create works based on her experience on the jury, which led some people to say, well, maybe she was not being truthful about her connection to the case so that she could get on this jury. What do we think about these issues here?
Yeah, okay. Well, first let me just say, having known Dr. Collins for a while, she could stand her ground in any situation with or without the protection of the law to do so.
Thanks, Dr.
But as to this, it's a difficult question because, in truth, I firmly believe we have the best judicial system and process in the world. And is it a flawed process? Yes. Does it sometimes give us results that we don't think are right? Absolutely. I don't know necessarily how you improve upon it in a democratic society. And quite frankly, I disagree with the notion that juries always end up with the most ignorant people and folks who just don't want to be informed. The issue is, sometimes in these cases that are very highlighted and that evoke such emotion, you get more involved than you are. I mean, there are literally thousands of jury trials going on every day across America. We have very well-educated, very well-informed, and responsible jurors. But the challenge is you have these kind of cases that have a spotlight, and certainly if the verdict doesn't come down the way we think it should as a society, as a community, there is a tendency to think, well, this was not a qualified jury. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't, and qualified is a subjective term. But I don't know in terms of how you improve upon it. I know that, typically in the jury selection process, there's questionnaires. But like Alex said, you get us lawyers involved, and we can screw just about anything up, right? So, we use peremptory challenges, challenges for cause, and part of it is strategy, too. I don't know necessarily. I think we have a very good system. It is a flawed system, but I'm not sure how we improve upon it.
One of the things that I heard, my sister-in-law is a judge in Indiana. She was surprised that it was a six-person jury. Is that part of the problem, that a murder trial as high profile as this was only decided by six jurors?
Well, unfortunately, that's just apparent. That is how the law is written in Florida. If it's capital, life is on the line, it's going to be a 12-person jury. Other than that, under the rule, it's going to be six. It's going to be a six-person. That's just how the law is written.
Well, I'm just wondering, does that concern anybody? Does that make it
Well, in state court, that's how it is. Now, in federal court, there's a 12-person jury all the time. You don't want to go to the federal, trust me. I don't think that's part of the problem.
And fingerprints, yeah. And other people testing.
But in state court, when I was doing state practice, I wasn't concerned about that many jurors because once you get into your strategies and things of that nature and presenting your case, I think whether it's 6 or 12, it's really not going to make a difference.
Okay. Let's hear from the next question.
I'm Julie Harris. First, I want to thank all the panelists for coming. Appreciate this. I, too, like Corey, am a civil attorney, and so I did watch the trial more so for the fact that I do not do criminal law. Mm-hmm. This was interesting to me. But the question I did have is for Mr. Camino, and if I mispronounce your last name,
No, that was right.
I actually read the jury instructions, and so upon reading the jury instructions, I totally understand why they came to the decision that they came to. But the one thing that did puzzle me was, if Stand Your Ground, it's my understanding, if this is wrong, correct me, Stand Your Ground was not applicable in this case. When you read the jury instructions, it appears that they track the language from the Stand Your Ground statute into the jury instructions. So if it wasn't applicable, then why would they put that into the jury instructions? Because to me, it confuses the jury that already articulated they were confused anyway. So if it wasn't applicable, it was only using common law Stand Your Ground, then why track the language from the statute into the jury instructions? And you know, maybe it's a strategy as well. That was something that was curious to me.
Thank you for your question. And if I could just touch on that jury question that you had too. I think one of the ways that we can try to ensure that we have good jurors is like people like you and you that confront me with something and you ask me about something that I may have said and have the person explain it. And when you're in jury selection and a person says, you know, I don't think I can be fair and impartial or I've had this experience, you not necessarily get up in their face, but you got to say, well, what do you mean by that? And explain that and make them sort of explain themselves in front of a group of people and maybe they'll change their mind or maybe they'll change the mind of the other people who are sitting next to them in the sense that, hey, wait, this is something really serious and we need to try and ensure that the person's getting a fair process. But with respect to the jury instruction, I don't think that it wasn't that it was not applicable. It's that it wasn't not applicable, in the sense that the state didn't prove that George Zimmerman was engaged in an unlawful activity under the law. If you can prove that certain jury instructions are not applicable, then you can strike them, and they won't go to the jury. But the state did not prove that those particular instructions were not applicable in this case, so they would still be available for the defense to argue if they wanted to. And again, I'd have to defer to Ben as to how much focus they put on that language, the no duty to retreat and the person can stand their ground, or if they just went ahead and said, hey, look, this is just plain old justifiable use of deadly force. He's using deadly force in a situation where he reasonably believes that his life was in danger. Do you remember how much they focused on that or on the language?
Yeah, Ben, do you have any sense about how that language would happen?
It's interesting because there's even confusion inside among my colleagues about how much Stand Your Ground, what role it played in this trial. For me, I have no question, primarily because the juror who spoke with Anderson Cooper pointed directly to Stand Your Ground three or four times, suggesting we had no other choice. The way the law was, or the way our instructions were written. And again, I mean, page 12, somebody tried to tell me, oh, it was buried in, you know, in the back. Well, these are 18 pages on page 12. So I don't know. It's not the case that's, you know, that phrase, Stand Your Ground, was mentioned more than a handful of times at trial. But the entire defense case was built on Stand Your Ground. George Zimmerman had a right to be where he was. You know, they argue he didn't start the, you know, he didn't initiate the confrontation. So all of those things are factors in this. Just because they're not saying Stand Your Ground, Stand Your Ground, Stand Your Ground, doesn't mean that didn't have anything to do with the case. In my view, it had everything to do with it.
Yeah, And so we think that language wound up in the jury instruction as a strategy by the defense. Is that what we think?
Joe, is it a standard instruction?
Yep.
It's a standard instruction. It wasn't our. I wasn't tuned in for the arguments about jury instructions.
All right, sir. Name and your question.
I'm Michael.
We have the most attractive Michael ever.
Good evening. My name is Roderick Johnson. I live in South Tampa. I want to personally thank Janice for the coordination, Eric for your depth of moderation, and for all the panelists. We thank you for your wisdom and your intelligence. My interest is more on the first few words on that title slide above you, which is more exploring the issues evoked by the case rather than just the trial itself. I know we've gone at length in terms of standing ground rule and the facts behind that. But if you look around this community here, I mean, we are surrounded by people from many different generations, those who have been to the civil rights, those who have been in the middle, I would say, and those in our new generation who are used to the social media generation. So as you can see, and also by the reaction that you see here, we have a wide range of reactions about this case. But my question to each one of you all, do you honestly believe that if we got rid of stand your ground rule, that it would actually improve the condition of the black community? Are we looking at this problem the right way? Do we think that by abolishing this rule is going to improve the condition of the black family? Is it going to improve the condition of black-on-black crime? Is it going to reduce the amount of black stereotypes and negative stereotypes that happen in our community? I think this is our frustration. Our frustration is that we're not given the benefit of the doubt, maybe in the court of public opinion, or I guess in this case, the court of law. But are we attacking this the right way? I'm a person that wants to see improvement in the black community. Do we honestly believe that by putting our attention towards getting rid of standing ground law, it's going to really improve the overall condition of the black community? I like your community.
All right.
I got the mic, so I'm going to go first. Thank you, Porter, for giving me that input. I have some flyers. It's probably not enough, but these are some flyers that the NAACP has put together. And from a national perspective, both regional and statewide, we put together, as we always do with any issue, a call to action. I'm going to actually tell you what the actions that we have here. Honor Trayvon's memory. Support him. And we said that because there are so many Trayvons in our community and across this country. To support and promote Trayvon parents, Tracy and Sabrina's requests for peace. Because we got so many calls from the media that said we were rioting at the NAACP office. And fortunately, we have been working with the media, and they know that we were not promoting riots. Were we, Attorney? Attorney Hallman, what did we do? We went out there to even talk with the teachers, the educators, had community forums, trying to keep things calm, and even pursuing it beyond school. So no, we didn't, but the media was saying that we were. We also called for the Justice Department to go ahead and do their investigation. We decided to have mass meetings and to participate in any that anyone asked us to be at. We've had two, and we are here, and we'll be anywhere. We'll be somewhere in a couple of weeks, and anywhere someone asks us. And I have to tip my hat off and due diligence to Attorney Charles Hallman, because he's been there on behalf of the NAACP with the marching orders that we've received. Push for the passage of five pieces of ombudsman-type legislation, Trayvon, and we call it the Trayvon Law Package. And it's not all for Trayvon. And the five are: eliminate racial profiling, creation of a community citizen complaint review board with 10 points that the NAACP has put together almost like a term paper. It's a very explicit that they're asking us to do in our communities all over this country. Determination and implementation of best practice for community watch groups, utilizing a packet that the NAACP has put together and willing to give to them. Because despite all of this, everything that I keep hearing is you're supposed to be in the car for the community, You're supposed to not have a gun on you, and I just can't get past that. So, yes, I'm still surprised. Demand the data be disaggregated so that we could actually take a look at what we said. Why can't we find out? I have 82 that came from the 13th Judicial Court that they have associated with Thaddeus Brown. We have 4 of those that came into our office before Trayvon. There's a young African-American man that was home from college that is dead, and nobody was arrested. And they went next door to get a gun. You know, the parents came to us and wanted us to sit in with Mark Obersoff. They had their own attorney. So we want this data being disaggregated so we can really look at it, begin to study it, and find out with our legal minds what can and cannot be done. And in addition to that, we ask a call for repeal of Stand Your Ground law. No question, any type of law like that. And we need to look at what was the impetus behind this law. Where did it really come from? And what is it doing all over the United States of America? So I agree with you. Just changing the law is not going to do anything. There's so much we need to do in housing and education and economic development and all of these kind of areas. But this has happened, and we need to try to correct it now.
We got one other person who wants to take that before we
I don't even begin to know how to answer that question. It's giant and complicated. I will say, covering this trial exposed me to this shameful, dark, racist segment of society that I kind of knew existed, but I wasn't sure exactly how nasty it was. If y'all could have listened to my voicemail, read some of the emails that I got, some of the letters that didn't have return addresses on them.
They never had return addresses.
Never.
Yeah, we get quite a few.
But it's almost like this has become the issue of the day. Let me apologize for those people, because you ask certain white people for directions to the mall, and they say, it wasn't about race, black people are rioting, and Stand Your Ground is awesome. And it's like, what? You know? Yeah. I don't know where this comes from. But it's shameful. And until we can maybe they'll die off. I don't know. Until we can get past that.
Yeah, I can say I wrote a column that said that reasonable doubt seemed insurmountable in this case. And people wrote me letters saying that I was challenging the jury verdict, and why did I say they got it wrong? And I'm like, that's not my role. Yeah. But I was the one guy who wrote about your resentment, so I must have been challenging the jury verdict. Anyway.
My name is Joyce Russell, and I live in Brandon, Florida. And listening to all the panelists, it sounds to me like this law is terribly complex, and I doubt if anybody understands all of it, and it's still getting to be, more and more intricate. But I think as it pertains to Trayvon, at the end of the day, you have a dead child who had a right to be in that neighborhood and who had done nothing and only had, Skittles on him, and he's dead. It could have been any of our children, black or white. I'd like to ask everybody in here, what if your child just happened to be walking in the neighborhood and someone is afraid because they've been having robberies in that neighborhood and your kid is just walking there and someone feels that they look suspicious, and at the end of the day, your child is dead and they did absolutely nothing wrong? So we have to look at what causes something like this to happen, and what can we do to prevent this from happening? So my question is to the George Edgecombe Bar Association, are you going to be involved in when the legislature calls this session? For here, it's not a legislative session. They're going to do another hearing. will there be some representation there, you all are attorneys, where you can be on record as saying something about this law? I know Carolyn and the NAACP got it covered, but I was impressed in coming here tonight because I said, wow, the George Edgecombe Bar Association is involved in this, and the black journalists. I'm not sure journalists can do this legally, but I don't know how they work. But I know attorneys can. And I would just like to know, are you all going to take the next step and maybe partner with some people and come up with some kind of legal statement or something to amend, change, abolish, whatever? You need to be on record somewhere. That's my question.
Well, thank you for your question. As it relates to the George Edgecombe Bar Association, you have to understand that we're an association not just of lawyers, but also members of the judiciary. So it becomes very difficult for George Edgecombe, and we affectionately refer to it as GEBA, to take a position on a law, because that could be seen as undermining our members of the judiciary who have to make rulings based on that law. But what we do is this, is we try to partner and provide opportunities for the community to have discussions about the law. And what I will say is, but we are an organization of individuals, and certainly there are individual lawyers that are in our association that are very involved with this particular law and seeing that it is addressed and that amendments are made to it. We have members that are very committed to that, and that's their individual choice to do it. As a bar association, because of how we're set up, that's not something that we can do. But our individual members are very involved, and we also, that's why we thought it was very important that we would do this with the Tampa Bay Association of Black Journalists, because we do think the community has to, you know, have a forum where they can talk about this and be informed about the law and about the impact of it. And if I could just briefly go back to this young man's question who asked about the condition of the black community, there is no silver bullet, because if there were, we would have figured it out a long time ago. And no, I don't think the revision of this law or any law is going to have the effect of turning around what we may consider difficult conditions in the black community. But every step matters. And if there is a law that the community feels is going to have a disproportionate effect and impact on African Americans, it needs to be addressed. But I will say that within the black community, you know, it starts with us. And
Thank you.
We've got to be, as we all know, we've got to be the agents of change that we're looking for. And it's interesting because I have an 8-year-old son, or he's about to be 8, and it's an interesting thing when you have to begin having this kind of a conversation with your child at 6, 7, 8 years old. It's a conversation, and I'm not sure if, you know, white counterparts even understand this about the black community, but we have to have a discussion with our children different than the discussion that you might ever have to have with your children about what it means to be African American, what it means to be black, and how people may make certain assumptions about you. And that not only certain assumptions that, you know, well, I don't care if this person thinks something about it, but assumptions that might impact your life, an employer, a police officer, a judge. And so those are the kind of discussions that we have to have early. And I hope that there's a time when we don't have to have those discussions. Monica, who was speaking, who asked the question a little earlier, she's got a 16-year-old, and she's become very passionate about this because she had to have that immediate discussion. And you don't realize that, and then you see something like this, and because in 8 years, my son will be Trayvon, and I live in a subdivision, and he might be walking home from the convenience store. And that's just something that I've got to think about even now, 8 years before that time, and trying to impart knowledge on him how he would handle himself in that kind of situation. So it's very difficult. But, you know, for us, it starts with us. And I'm very encouraged by of course, what the NAACP is doing, and by having these kind of forums we can talk about these issues.
Yeah, I got to say, what's interesting, a couple things are interesting to me about this, though. The first thing that's interesting to me is that if you believe Trayvon's parents, there's nothing really he could have done differently. He was walking where he was supposed to be. He was headed towards his father's girlfriend's abode,
He'd been there before. And he ends up dead. So I don't know what you touch your kids, because it's entirely possible he didn't do anything wrong. And so I wonder, the thing that strikes me about this situation is that there is no witness to how Christ started at St. George. So is the lesson of this, make sure there's a witness? Is it that simple? And I ask that seriously of the lawyers on the panel. I mean, is it that simple that someone has to see how these fights start?
Well, you know, just regrettably, there is no witness. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I do need to get this off my chest. I just thought everything was just lost. My question to the world, what set everything off? What caused this? And that's George Zimmerman got out of his car. Bottom line. Not only did he get out of his car, he got out of his car armed. Now, you were saying something earlier. They said, don't follow him. And he said, okay, or whatever case may have been. Well, how do you get from your car to the T-spot? And that got lost. We talked about theories of the case. I told you about that. I don't even know if the prosecution even stayed on that. Maybe they left that and just headed and left. But I think that was...
You guys had a whole animation of the show. And that was the closing argument.
But let me say this. Let me say this. And I don't know what else, how else to answer your question, but I do want to say this. You know, this guy Zimmerman was talking about, well, they always get away. Well, who? You were talking about, you saw one person, so where does the they come from? Did the prosecution develop that? I don't think they did. I don't know.
They tried.
Well, we got to stay there. When you're in trial, we're here to win. You have to develop these things. Then he said, well, he looked suspicious. Well, Jesus was suspicious on Palm Sunday. So what does a suspicious person look like? Now, Terry versus Ohio says that a police officer, if he's not going to arrest someone, probable cause, he has to articulate a reason for stopping someone. Yes, that's government or state action. So Zimmerman said he was suspicious. So I want to know what was suspicious about him. Point three, they said he was peeking in windows. So prosecution, isn't that what was said? He was peeking in windows, or someone said something to that effect. Okay, there's a grid. Let's go interview all these witnesses. That's how I work my case. Let's go interview all these residents. Did you see Trayvon Martin or this black guy peeping in your windows? And the answer to all those questions are just a resounding no. Final point, I do need to say this. There was a grave mistake made during the trial when Don West asked Rachel Gentile, he asked Serrano, so you believed George Zimmerman. Everybody remember that?
Yeah.
Now, who is the most powerful person in a courtroom during a trial? No, the jury. I don't care if the judge hates your guts. If the jury says not guilty, it's over. Now, was there an objection when that question was asked of Serrano? So you believed George Zimmerman's story. There should have been an objection to that, Joe, because now they have invaded the province of the jury. The judge is the trier of fact. I'm sorry, the judge is the trier of law. The jury is the trier of fact. The jury makes the determination of who is telling the truth. Now, there was no objection to that. Now, when you go back, and I challenge you tonight, I'm giving everyone in here a homework assignment. Go back and listen to juror B37. She said she believes Serrano because he believed George Zimmerman.
Yeah.
The judge, there was no what we call a contemporaneous objection. Object now. He did not object. Then in the morning, they tried to fix that. That's what we call a curative instruction. Well, you can't unring the bell. And that's been, now that hurt that trial. Now, why didn't the prosecution ask for a mistrial? Who asked the question? Because you got a jeopardy issue now. Who asked that question? Don West of the defense. So now we don't have a jeopardy question now. So the prosecution should have asked for what? A mistrial. Especially if you're not satisfied with what? The jury.
Thank you. I will say quickly that Zimmerman in his interview with Sean Hannity said that he thought Trayvon looked suspicious because he was weaving in the ground. He looked like he might have said. I'm just telling you what he says. And that's likely what he was said to you, but I don't understand. The other thing that struck me is all the stuff about Trayvon that was on Twitter, the photos and things like that, if there is something you're going to tell your kids, it might be to be careful about that stuff. Because after Trayvon was dead, conservative media outlets used that to make Trayvon look like a thug, whether or not he was. So even though you think the things you're tweeting to your friends on Twitter, on Facebook, may not come out, even after Trayvon Martin was dead and his social media accounts were shut down, neo-Nazi websites found the material and put it back out there. And the defense also retrieved stuff like that from his cell phone.
Real quick, young people in college, all this technology, when you're going to look for a job, you know what your employer does? They go to social media websites. Now, do you really think you're going to get a job? I think that should be the message to our young people. Mm-hmm. Now, they shut down the Facebook account and Twitter, Facebook and all that other stuff.
Just shut it down completely.
Why would they shut it down completely?
You understand the point.
You're not going to be a journalist if you're not on Twitter. But I would say be careful about what you tweet because, I mean, Trayvon's Twitter handle was No Limit Digger. Now, are you going to get a job when they look up and they see that that's your Twitter handle? Maybe not. You know, so you might want to rethink that. Okay.
I'd like to thank all the participants in the forum. And Mr. Hall,
yes, sir.
You had posed a question to the world. I wanted people in the world to honestly believe that if he didn't have the gun, he may not have followed Trayvon. That was a big part of it. And
I agree.
I'd like to preface my question with something following up with Ms. Collins said. And that's with regards to like in 2005 when this bill was actually passed.
Okay.
Right next to Jed when he passed it was Mary Ann Hall, representative with the lobbyist with the NRA. And Wayne LaPierre, he also spoke about spreading the Stand Your Ground to all the different states. And Alec had a hand in helping write it. So to get to the actual question, was it really needed? Is it something that was actually needed, or was there a monetary basis for the passing of the law?
Joe, did the
task
force think about that?
Joe's going to answer. Oh, Joe answered, but I need to say no, it wasn't needed. And the statistics on the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, just go Google it. Their statistics tell you it wasn't needed because it got worse. And if you look at the University of Miami in 2009, they did a law review on Stand Your Ground. This is one of the comments. In many instances where deadly force is used, there are two witnesses. One of them is dead. That leaves one version of the event from a person motivated by self-interest.
I was just going to say, the prosecutors and police chiefs across the state asked this very question in the run-up to the passage. Show us a case where someone was aggressively prosecuted and, they were protected under the same law. And the law's sponsors and backers pointed to the case of James Workman, a guy who lived in, a retiree who lived in Pensacola. It was after a hurricane had blown through. He and his wife retreated to a mountain home, and they'd come back to Pensacola to find their home damaged, their front porch messed up, their roof messed up. And they were staying in an RV in the front yard. And the way it was painted by the law's backers, and this was repeated time and again to the press, actually on the floor of the House and Senate, they were arguing for it, was that this man attacked James Workman, that James Workman fired his gun, and then in some cases it was said he was arrested, in other cases it was said he had to hire a lawyer and was in legal limbo for 6 months while they decided whether he was protected under the self-defense law, etc. It was a distortion of this case. I know that because I went back and interviewed James Workman, who said, I never wanted to be the poster boy for this case. He would have been protected and was protected under the law that was in place in 2004. Legal limbo, 3 months it took he was never arrested. 3 months it took state prosecutors to announce to him they weren't going to bring charges because he was justified in using deadly force under the laws that existed in 2004. So the backers of this law had to distort the story in order to make it work to get the passage of this law.
So that's it, man. It's all
Joe, you
want
to add anything?
I don't know that it was something that was a necessary amendment. I think that was your question, right? Whether or not it was necessary or what were the...
No, was the law itself, was it necessary? Was it an improvement upon what was already there?
I think from some people's standpoint, from what I heard from Mr. Baxley, and I'm in no way here jumping up and down saying this is a great law and it shouldn't be repealed or anything like that. I think if there's a law that where there's a sentiment from people that are affected by the law that it's being that it's an unfair law, then it certainly needs to be reviewed objectively. But I can't see that it was something that was a necessary amendment. Prior to the amendment, law enforcement still had to make a finding as to whether or not the evidence supported that the person was not justified when making their decision to arrest someone. And I think that what this law did was provide a lot of confusion on how they make their decision-making process. The one good thing that I think that came from this law is the ability for a person who's charged with the crime to have a pretrial hearing to make a decision, a judge to make a decision that is reviewable by the District Court of Appeals as to whether or not they have to proceed to trial. And the only reason I think that's a good idea is because in the firearm cases, in state court, people face 20-year minimum mandatories, like the young lady from Jacksonville is currently serving, or 25-year minimum mandatories if they actually cause damage with a bullet. And so you'll have young men or young women who are facing the possibility of being convicted and facing 25-year minimum mandatories if they're convicted at trial when they have no prior record. And it encourages the minimum mandatories in a way, encourages forced pleas in the sense that, hey, man, you know, state attorneys, we're making you an offer of adjudication, which means the person's going to be a convicted felon, and probation. Otherwise, you're going to have to go to trial and face the possibility of serving 25 years day for day. How about it? And a lot of people are pleading out for that. So I think that some focus, and I know this is getting kind of off topic of your question, but there needs to be a focus from the NAACP, I'm sorry. This lady over here is still getting to me. NAACP, when y'all address this law, make sure you talk about the minimum mandatories and all the people that are currently in prison because of the minimum mandatories. But it didn't seem like it was a necessary law to pass.
How many states have the standing law, and actually there's 18, and that's not including Florida, versus Castle Domain. I appreciate the information from Ms. Carolyn, because I had the same question as he did, so that question was answered. But my question is, how would this have been manslaughter? In order for this, the case, you know, you all were saying, I'm surprised that this wasn't manslaughter, how would that have been, or wouldn't it have been, you had to have, you know, go to the charge or whatever and say manslaughter in order for the verdict to be manslaughter? Or how could the second degree murder convert to manslaughter if it wasn't put on the panel as an option of manslaughter?
They had that option. After both sides rested, they asked to add manslaughter, and they also asked for third-degree murder, like abuse of a child or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And that was rejected. So when the case went to the jury, they were allowed to consider second-degree murder or manslaughter. I'm looking up states with the Stand Your Ground law, but I believe there's a lot of states that are in the process of passing the law, so there's more than 18.
According to the Legal Defense Fund, February 26, 2012, with the NAACP, at the writing of our resolution, 32 states have copied at least parts of the law, if not all of it, of Florida statute, and at least 5 states include have the immunity provision in it.
Yeah. Okay.
Good evening. My name is Elsa Coffey. I'm One thing I do want to just mention, I know there was a discussion that Dr. Collins had about us registering to vote and then discussion about being on juries. That is not how jury selections are chosen. It's not about being registered to vote. It is based on valid driver's license. It comes from the clerk of court's office. So let's make sure when we're asking people to register that that's not an excuse they give us. I don't want to call to a jury. Well, if you have a valid driver's license, that's where that list comes. So I just want to make sure there's a clear
that, that's for the state. Federal, it is voting.
I'm sorry, yes. Correct, that is state, correct. Right. Federal, it is voting, but state.
So where's your vote? And here's your
vote. There we go. My question is, I had a conversation with my personal House state rep this week, so my question is, what laws do we need to have changed? Is that, would one of them be that maybe it needs to be 12-man jury? Is that the type of discussion we need to be having with our state representatives and senators? Because what I asked was that, because I don't feel Stand Your Ground is going to be repealed, what I did ask, though, was if I'm in the act of committing a felony, I should not be able to use Stand Your Ground. Or if I am the aggressor, I should not be able to use Stand Your Ground. So his discussion back to me was that if they pull out the aggressor part, that also goes to the self-defense. But are those the types of questions that we need to be having discussion with those that represent us when they're in Tallahassee, that this is the discussion they need to have with their fellow folks to have removed? Maybe we can chip away at this piece by piece, but what are some of the things we need to ask for?
I do believe, Joe, you already said, right?
If
you're committing a felony or if you're the aggressor, you're not allowed to use state ground as a defense, right?
Yes, and yes, minimum mandatory. Go and talk to that your representative about that because that's a bunch of garbage. I don't know why we'd have judges in the first place if they don't have any discretion.
But I think to that point, it's self-defense you can use if I'm the aggressor, right?
Okay, I have a copy, and you know, you can have this copy of the statute that I printed. You want it? There are two parts of the statute as I read it, and I highlighted it. If you are engaged in an unlawful activity, then you cannot use this pretrial motion and assert that you're immune from prosecution. That's a fact. I think some of the cases that came out in the Times, though, early on, before the case law developed, people that were just carrying guns at bars and that were convicted felons, they were somehow able to utilize this law because there was no case law that had developed on it yet. But the case law is clear today, in 2013. If you are a convicted felon, you're engaged in unlawful activity. And you can make the argument that if you're jaywalking, you're engaged in an unlawful activity and you shouldn't be able to use this law as a pretrial motion. So the law is clear, the case law is clear, that if you're engaged in unlawful activity, selling drugs, possessing drugs. I had a case where my client shot somebody right after he snorted a line of cocaine. The judge found, quite frankly, that he was engaged in unlawful activity possessing cocaine. So he was not able to use this law. And with respect to the other aspect of your question, the law is clear. If you're the initial aggressor, the part that Ben was talking about, where it says that if you're engaged in a lawful activity, that's a preceding paragraph to the paragraph that says the preceding paragraphs do not apply if you are the initial aggressor, unless you prove that it was reasonable for you to use that deadly force. So if your representative doesn't know that, that's a problem. You know, but everybody in this room, if there's anything that I would feel good about when we leave tonight, that everybody knows that's part of the law. And I don't know, I have to defer to Ben. If I'm the prosecutor, I'm up there arguing. George Zimmerman was the initial aggressor. So all these instructions that come before this part, and it's towards the end, don't apply. And I don't know that that was argued and that was the focus of the presentation. It goes back to what Alec was talking about before, what happens from the very beginning, the fact that they didn't bag with paper bags Trayvon's hands, and all the way through the presentation of the trial where they put all that mitigation and let George Zimmerman's voice be heard in their case. You know, there's a lot of tension right now because of this verdict, and some of it is placed on this law. That law was good enough to get the young lady in Jacksonville in jail for 20 years and by the same prosecutor. So I think if we're really looking at fairness, we need to look at what was done in that case that may not have been done in this case.
what was presented in Jacksonville that wasn't presented in Sanford? And what happened? And why is that verdict like this? And if it comes down to the law and the law's unfair, then we need to revisit that too. But we also need to look at the presentations that were made by the prosecution and why it was presented that way.
So just so I'm clear, you're saying the law has changed some since it originally came out of—
It's developed. Developed.
Okay. Because you do have cases, and that's what I was basing that discussion on with my representative earlier, that there were drug dealers that had utilized this from down in Miami, and they got away with killing. So it has evolved then.
It's evolved. But listen to this. When you read that statute, what was your name?
Ellen.
When you read that statute, there's not going to be anything in there that says that you have a right if you're accused to a pretrial hearing. It's not in there. That was developed by the Florida Supreme Court in a case where they said, hey, you know what we're going to do? We're going to have the person have a right to a pretrial hearing.
Yeah, so that's the way the law works, unfortunately.
Can I see that, Joe?
The law gets passed, and then you have decisions, court decisions that set precedents. And so, unfortunately, early in the law, I mean, I got to say, if I was a criminal defense attorney and I saw a law like this, I'd be using it, too, to help maybe some people who are, we might see, say, or unsavory, justify their actions until there's case law built up to make that harder.
I was just going to point out that, like, the point of contention, I think, in this and applying that provision you talk about is what is aggressor, you know? How do you define aggressor? What is pursuit? And these things were hashed out indeed in this trial with the prosecution saying, look, he set his course by saying these assholes and, you know, effing punks. That's him showing ill will. That's him suggesting he's going to pursue. And the defense argued, no, he wasn't pursuing. The police officer just after that asked him where he was, and he didn't know. And so he's walking. He's not in pursuit. He's just walking in the same direction. So this is what was at play. Is he protected by that provision that suggests that an aggressor is not protected by standard ground? And ultimately, the jury decided
And I would suggest that one of the big problems is that he didn't have anybody else to counter his government's account of what he did.
Right.
So if somebody else had seen it, maybe they could have said, well, then no, he went out of the case or whatever. You know. So we need to get through these next two really quick. So if you could just really quickly give us a question and really quickly give us an answer, so because we're going to have to ask yourself.
My name is Divya Kumar, and I'm a student here at USF. My question is, what role do you feel the media's coverage of both the legal issues involved as well as societal issues or
anything? Well, Eric is probably the best person positioned to answer this question. I would just say that, man, any more, and by the way, buy that book, it's phenomenal. Oh, any more, it always rubbed me the wrong way to hear people say the media. Because we're talking about a giant swath anymore of stuff. We're talking about Facebook, and we're talking about Twitter, and we're talking about how many news channels are there, and 24-hour news channels, and, you know, newspapers, and news magazines, and pamphlets. And so to answer that, like, did the media, you know, are the things we can learn as the media about how to handle these cases and how to do better? I think it's particularly each different form of media, you know?
The first chapter of this book talks a lot about that, so if you're really interested, I would say grab one of these books and it'll explain it. But I feel like you can look at different types of media and see different kinds of coverage. So newspapers were more focused on details and facts and trying to figure out what actually happened in this killing and what was the context. And they were set in mind to figure out what particular were really aggressive about. Television is about emotion. So television was channeling all this emotion, and a lot of times it was passing along this information. People would say things on a cable news channel, and people would hear it and they would think, oh, that's what happened. People said that George Zimmerman was lying to keep his gun. No, he wasn't. People said that his clothing wasn't tested to see if he fired it. That wasn't true. People said he wasn't questioned after the killing. That's not true. So there was a lot of misinformation about what happened in terms of the immediate reaction of the police and how it was investigated and all these different details. And people hear it and they that's all they remember, right? And then Twitter and social media was about action. So
was constantly calling people to action. Go to this protest, sign this petition, come to this, you know, gathering and talk about it. So I would say each piece of media pursued a different agenda based on what they were about. And either helped the situation or hurt it. I mean, social media made a lot of people learn this case. But it also pushed people to be really passionate about it in ways that were good and bad. The newspapers provided a lot of information. But early on, we had a picture of George Zimmerman from the 2005 mugshot and a picture of Trayvon Martin when he was 2 years younger, looking much younger and, you know, less developed than he really was when he died. So, you know, each side of me did things right.
And then last person, Mr. Harris. Dr. Patricia Grant Harris from Puerto Rico. And I guess to be in, at the end, this is kind of an ending question for the panel. Appreciating all of the information that was shared because it's been illuminating as well as informative, and I certainly appreciate the information that the NAACP has gathered and what you are doing, Dr. Collins. But for me, as the justice issue and one of looking for execution steps going forward, my question is, where do we go from here?
Thank you.
What is being done? Where we go through here regarding the Stand Your Ground law revision, where do we go from here regarding influencing the perfecting of jury selection? Where do we go from here regarding influencing the prosecutor's office so that a better and more developed, a more in-depth, more strategic, and more expansive case is brought forward the next time so that we aren't repeating at least all of the same processes and steps on the next case?
I would ask each person on the panel to respond to this, but please, a minute or less. Very quickly.
That's such a tough question. Just very quickly, the simplest thing is going to sound lame. Get to know your neighbors. Be kind to your neighbors. Make a community where you live. I don't think there's a need for a neighborhood watch if everyone knows each other and if everyone's talking and if there's open lines of communication. You don't need a guy driving around with a loader, but I didn't mind you. Now, that's just like so lame, but that's a bare bones thing. Be kind to people and get to know people and talk to people. And, sorry, how's that? What do you think about that answer?
Commercial, NAACP is 308 Dr. Martin Luther King. Our phone number is 23-I-VOTE. Ella Coffey, one of our officers, is there. We would ask that if you feel you just do not want to join the NAACP, that's fine. But come to a committee meeting and perhaps get involved. You may then want to join. Our legal redress chair here is having committee meetings addressing a number of issues like that. Our website, HillsboroNAACP.org, the bus ride for August 23rd, 22nd, 23rd, and as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s son said it so well, we're not celebrating the March on Washington. The struggle continues. If anyone wants any of these brochures, that'll give you that information, but more importantly, it gives you the statistics from the courts and it gives you just the bullet points on justifiable homicide. I think we've got to get involved in the community and stop using the excuse. Ella said what she said, but the key point is, you may not drive, but you certainly can vote. and you can take kids to the polls with you to vote. We need to make sure everybody register and vote, and those that are not eligible, we need to work on finding out why we're about to do another purge in Hillsborough County in the state of Florida and taking people off the roll rather than changing Stand Your Ground.
All right, Joe.
Thank you. I think that we should do what Ms. Coffey did and go speak to our representatives and voice your concerns through to your representatives and our senators. Also, with respect to this law, I think that in any law, what we're all looking for, I'm a criminal defense attorney. I want my client to be treated fairly. And when I pick a jury, the first thing that the state does is they get out their laptop, and every African-American on the jury panel, they look to see if they're a convicted felon and if they're lying about that. That's what they do. You know, sometimes I'm so caught up in trying to take my notes or find out who these people are that I don't see them do it. And it's only when I find out that the person was a convicted felon or they found it that they weren't being truthful. But with this law, people who are affected by this law and you feel like you were not given justice, there needs to be, I think, a review process for one state attorney making a decision that a charge should not be brought. I think that's something that the NAACP, got it right that time, sorry, needs to address too. Trayvon Martin, while George Zimmerman was found not guilty, his family, they got a review from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. There's plenty of families that Art's familiar with that didn't get a review. I don't think that's right. And they don't think that this law is fair. There needs to be a review process put in place, and I think that's something that needs to be addressed as well.
I would just say that if they're going to be homeowner association or neighborhood watch programs, just like we can pass laws, and tonight we've talked about passing laws, why don't we pass a law that if you're going to have these neighborhood watch associations, you cannot get out of your vehicle? Hello, somebody. Because this young man would still be alive if this man didn't get out of his car. And I just think that was lost in this whole trial. And so that's what I think. There ought to be a law that if you're going to participate in these neighborhood watch programs, you cannot get out of your vehicle. And you should not be carrying a firearm as well. Secondly, I think more funding needs to go into prosecution. And it's strange to hear a defense attorney saying that. But the federal government would spend a lot of money to prosecute you. But when we look at this presentation in the state, Bowles should have been fired on the witness stand.
Yes.
I mean, and I think that how much money you put in a case can sometimes determine the result.
Sure. And yeah, so one last, I just get to echo everyone else's sentiments on the panel. You know, talk to your congresspeople, talk to your elected representatives. You know, we want change. There's a couple ways we can affect change in the community. That's by voting. And I'm probably speaking to the choir here, but we got to do that. We've got to take part of our civic duties. Being on a jury is part of that. We have to do that. It has to be important. And I would say, you know, that is just ultimately so important for us to be involved in every aspect of our civic responsibilities. Because it's difficult to come back after the fact and say we want all this change, but we didn't vote. Mm-hmm. We've been dodging juries for years. And when it comes to juries, I'll say this. You can't perfect it because you're dealing with people, and people aren't perfect. So you'll never be able to perfect a jury system. And in truth, you could take the same case, and you're always going to have different opinions on whether or not the jury got it right in a lot of cases. So it's very difficult. We do have a good system. I don't want anyone in this room to walk out of here with no faith in our jury system. We do. But we've got to be a part of it and just be an actor. All right. So I want to thank our panelists.